Hello and welcome. This is Your Call. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Often when we talk about mass incarceration, we tend to focus on the problem of overpopulated prisons, and that certainly is a problem. Jail overcrowding is a major issue in California and across the country. But what you may not know is that jail growth is overwhelmingly due to pretrial detention. These are mostly folks who have not been convicted of a crime. They simply can't afford to post bail. Of the approximately 700,000 people in jail on any given day in the U.S., more than 60% of them have not even been sentenced. These are individuals who are considered innocent under the law. Historically, pretrial detention was reserved for individuals who were either a flight risk or who posed a serious risk to public safety. But since the 1980s, pretrial detentions have far outpaced the number of people convicted and actually serving sentences. According to Prison Policy Initiative, that group says in 1983, there were about 112,000 pretrial detentions nationally. Fast forward 30 years, in 2013, more than 400,000 people were serving pretrial detentions. That's a 74% increase. And according to a recent report by Human Rights Watch about California specifically and pretrial and bail bond systems in the state, quote, the state jails large numbers of people for hours and days against whom prosecutors have never even filed criminal charges. People accused of crimes but unable to afford bail give up their constitutional right to fight the charges because the plea will get them out of jail and back to work and their families. Judges and prosecutors know this, and they use custody status as leverage to pressure guilty pleas. It's quite a conundrum, and we're going to talk about the bail system today as it's practiced. Joining me to break down how pretrial detention and the bail bond system works and the implications of our current policies are two guests, starting with Joshua Norkin. Joshua is a staff attorney with Legal Aid of New York and their Special Litigation Unit. He currently oversees the Decarceration Project. It's a bail reform initiative that's focusing on eliminating unnecessary jailing of poor people in New York City. He previously worked as a public defender in Legal Aid's Bronx Trial Office and as an associate appellate counsel. Josh joins me on the line from New York. Hi, Josh. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yes, indeed. And Joshua will be talking in broad strokes about the national trends in the bail bond system. And Micah Doktoroff is with us as well. She's a legislative attorney for the ACLU of California Center for Advocacy and Policy. She's based out of Sacramento, where she focuses on state criminal justice legislation. She's been actively involved in California's statewide bail reform efforts, and she's on the line from Sacramento. Thanks for being here, Micah.
Thanks so much for having me.
For folks who, like me, don't even know the difference between bail and bond, let's just start with the basics. Joshua, if I'm arrested, what happens? And what's the difference between bail and bond?
So when you're arrested, the first thing that obviously happens is you're dealing with the police department, and you get processed. You probably get fingerprinted, and the police might then write up a narrative about what happened and do some interviewing of potential witnesses. And at some point after that, you are usually brought to either the courthouse or central booking, where the case begins to get processed for court and for hearings. You know, it probably varies in jurisdictions across the country, and it, you know, in some places might not happen so quickly. But at least in New York City, roughly within 24 hours, you would appear in front of a judge for your first appearance, who would then make a decision on bail. They'd inform you of the charges, and then they'd decide whether or not you should be released on your own recognizance, maybe without any restrictions, or whether or not they should set some bail amount that you would have to then post in order to get out of jail. And The difference, I don't think they're really, I think the words bail and bond might be sort of interchangeable, but I think practically and sort of generally the difference is that when we're sort of talking about bail, I think that sort of is a reference to cash bail. I think when we're talking about bail bonds, that is called an insurance company bond, which is a commercial bail bondsman that you would go to, pay a fee, and they would come to the courthouse and post the bail for you. So in either instance, you're referring to some form of monetary bail.
And so how does it work? How does a judge determine? How does bail even factor into whatever it is that you might be accused of? And how does the whole process of assessing bail amounts work?
Again, it probably varies in jurisdictions, but broadly speaking, the law basically says that there are two different reasons a judge could set bail pretrial. One is if they deem you or find you to be a flight risk or a failure to return to court, and the other is whether or not they might find that you're a danger to the community or might go back out and commit a new crime. And beyond, I think beyond that, there are also sort of specific offenses like murder or rape that a judge might not even grant you bail or the option of release entirely.
It sounds rather arbitrary and certainly up to the judge. According to the Sacramento Bee, California allows each county to set its own bail schedule by crime. In Sacramento, for example, the rates can range anywhere from $5,000 for possession of a controlled substance to $20,000 for resisting or deterring an officer, up to $1 million for a sexual assault on a child. Micah Doctoroff, can you talk about California and how it might differ here?
Yeah, so as you said, here in California, each county has a bail schedule, and a bail schedule is essentially a list of crimes and a list of corresponding amounts of money. And typically, if you can pay the amount listed on the bail schedule, you are released, and if you can't pay the amount on the bail schedule, you are typically left in jail. And so there's sort of a fundamental problem with this system in that whether you are released or detained is really based on whether you can afford bail, and it's conditioned on individual wealth as opposed to the intended purposes of bail, which, like Joshua said, are ensuring that people return to court as they are required and promoting public safety.
But it didn't used to be this way. The statistics, at least going back to the mid-80s, seem to show that it wasn't always this way, and yet there seems to have been a real explosion in pretrial detentions. Josh, do you have a theory of why that is?
I mean, I think that it's pretty clear that the sort of corresponding increase in pretrial detention, sort of mirrors the rise of mass incarceration, which I think sort of goes hand in hand with the war on drugs, and I think sort of the over-policing and hyper-policing of particularly communities of color across the country. Why the rise has been sort of confined or is more specifically in pretrial detention as opposed to convictions. I don't think I've got a specific theory of that, but I think that it's pretty clear that sort of the rise in the prison population mirrors some of the uglier aspects of our country's public policy over the past, 20 or 30 years.
Micah, I'm wondering if you have a thought on who tends to get caught in pretrial detention simply because they're unable to make bond.
I think that it typically are people who are unable to afford the amount of bail set, people who are low or moderate income. There is some interesting national data that, according to the Federal Reserve's recent report, when asked whether they could afford an emergency expense costing just $400, 46% of American adults said that they could either not cover the expense or that they would have to cover it by selling something or borrowing money. And we know that people who can't afford bail typically fall within the lowest, the poorest one-third of people in the country. So it's really an economic issue and not based on, like we discussed earlier, the real considerations, which are public safety and appearance in court.
Well, a new report out by Human Rights Watch says specifically in California, the system of money bail and pretrial detention discriminates based on wealth. The report says, quote, rich people simply pay bail and buy their freedom. People of more modest means sometimes can cobble together the money to pay a bondsman the 8 to 10% non-refundable fees normally charged to secure their release. In the 6 counties examined in California, 70 to 80% of arrestees could not or did not pay bail. Does that come as a surprise? Do those numbers tend to reflect across the country, Josh? Or is California particular in that way? My understanding is that bails are particularly high in California.
Well, it certainly sounds like, from what sort of was described earlier, that the fee schedules seem, at least to me, seem pretty high comparatively to what we see here in New York City. I think the numbers that you are citing of people that are being detained pretrial as a proportion of the jail population, I think 70 to 80% is pretty similar to what is being seen across the country. I think that's pretty similar to what we're seeing here in New York City, and I think that the rates of release in New York City strike me as higher, sort of looking at the numbers, than they are in California. But I think that those numbers are probably a relatively accurate reflection of what is happening across the country, which is that 70 to 80% of the local or state jail populations tend to be people that are essentially presumed innocent, not convicted of anything, and waiting for trial in jail because they can't afford to buy their way out.
Mike, I know you've looked specifically at California. Your thoughts on how the state stacks up when it comes to this?
Yeah, so California, here in California, the median bail amount is $50,000, which is 5 times higher than the national median, which is $10,000. So as compared with the rest of the country, California has very, very high bail amounts. $50,000 is clearly much more than most people can afford, but even the 10% fee that a person would pay to a commercial bail agent in order to secure their freedom is still a significant amount of money and significantly more than many people can pay. That's still $5,000, and many people in jail and their families are unable to afford even $5,000. As I mentioned earlier, the fact that so many Americans can't even afford $400 sort of gives you a sense of how far out of reach bail is for many people in California.
I confess that $50,000 figure really kind of took my breath away. Why is California so high?
I don't have a specific answer to that, but we, as I mentioned earlier, each county has its own bail schedule, and they vary considerably from county to county, and so we see sort of wildly different bail schedules across the state. But I think, as Joshua said earlier, this is sort of mirrors other criminal justice practices and sort of part of the problem with mass incarceration.
And can I just interject?
Sure.
And also, I just want to sort of, I think, maybe provide some context, at least here in New York. The median bail rate on violent felony charges in New York City is $7,500. So I think that's, to sort of put into context that $50,000 number, which is just ridiculous. But I think the sort of important thing to probably note is that for the poor people that we're sort of talking about here, somebody who, you know, somebody who can't make $500 bail, it's not going to matter whether or not that bail set at $7,500 or $50,000. It's just as out of reach. So the problem, I think, isn't necessarily defined by the scope of what the medium bail is when we're talking about, you know, this particular portion of the population that's getting trapped because they really don't have any resources to pay bail whatsoever.
Is there any kind of consistency in terms of what kinds of offenses are landing people in pretrial detentions, Micah?
Well, I mean, I think that it is really dependent on the amount of bail set. I mean, one of the problems with using a bail schedule and conditioning release really on how much money a person has and basing a release decision solely on the offense charged is that we're not actually getting at the real bail considerations, which again are ensuring that a person comes back to court and promoting public safety. And so what's required really is that a more thorough inquiry occur both into, you know, what are the actual conditions that are going to ensure return to court and public safety for that individual. And sometimes that will be, you know, as we talked about earlier, on recognizance release with no conditions. Sometimes it will be non-monetary conditions that are sufficient. And when money bail is assigned, it should be based both on the bail considerations, but also on whether that individual can actually afford that amount. Historically, the purpose of bail is really to facilitate release and ensure that somebody comes back to court, not to serve as a means of keeping the person in jail.
I think we all might recall the story of Khalif Browder. He was being detained at Rikers Island. I think he was charged with or accused of stealing a backpack or some minor crime. He was at Rikers Island, as it turns out, for 3 years before the prosecution ended up just dropping the case. Josh, just wondering, how common is it for people to be held for so long on pretrial detention?
Yeah, I think it is. I would like to say that it's a lot more uncommon these days following that tragedy than it was back then. You know, at that sort of period of time, there was a really large backload of cases in the Bronx where he was charged, and I think that the court administration has recognized that and has tried to make some attempt to sort of whittle away that backlog down so that there are people who are not really spending that much time in jail anymore pretrial. But it, you know, it does happen, and it obviously should never happen. And I think, you know, in sort of in particular, when we're sort of talking about Khalif Browder, it was this really sort of toxic mix of circumstances that led him to be caught up in the system for that long on a crime that he never committed. And I think it sort of goes beyond just the bail issue, but also in New York, we've sort of been having, or we do have, a very, very lax and relatively unenforceable speedy trial statute, which for years we have tried to get the legislature to remedy, and currently are sort of in the process of trying to get them to remedy it again so that things like this don't happen. And, you know, I think from our perspective, when we sort of think about Khalif Browder, we like to think that bail reform encompasses more than just the bail question itself, but is a much more sort of comprehensive approach to sort of redefining, you know, when people should be in jail, when people should be out of jail, and looking at things like discovery, speedy trial, and trying to divert cases from the criminal justice system. So, you know, I think we, having this conversation and having sort of now had Kalief Browder sort of brought to the forefront as this national tragedy, has, I think, sparked conversations that mean that people are not spending that much time in jail anymore. We certainly strive to make sure that that's not the case for any of our clients here at Legal Aid.
And, of course, tragically, he ended up committing suicide not too long after being released. And if I'm not mistaken, now Rikers is being shut down partially as a result of that, too. Am I right, Josh?
I wish that was true. We are certainly working towards that. We are at a point when where we sort of have this, I think, you know, meeting of the minds amongst the judiciary, amongst the from the governor's office and from the mayor's office, and as well as the sort of city council here in New York City, saying that we should be closing Rikers down. It's a terrible, very brutal place, and we should be relocating, you know, we should be sort of not just reducing the jail population, but relocating the jail populations to the local boroughs. And that's a conversation that has sort of just been pulled across the finish line in terms of getting everyone to say that we are going to close Rikers. Practically speaking, I think that we are not really at a point when we sort of, where we sort of have any definitive timeline or any real concrete path forward towards achieving that. And I think that's what we're working on right now, is trying to figure out how we can get Rikers Island closed. Some of the time frames have suggested as much as 10 years. We obviously think that it should happen much sooner than that, and we could do it a lot more quickly if we implemented some of the reforms we think are necessary.
Okay, we want to invite our listeners. Please give us a call. What questions do you have about our pretrial and bail bond system? Have you ever been detained and couldn't afford to post the bail? And we'd be grateful if you'd share your story with us. Perhaps you work in law enforcement. What are your thoughts on how pretrial detention and bail work in your jurisdiction? Give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255, or you can drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Post a comment on the web at yourcallradio.org. We have an email from a listener who says, I was arrested on the basis of a completely false report given by the domestic partner I was living with. Eventually, the DA dropped the case because I was able to provide court records from Alameda and LA counties showing he had done the same thing twice before. But in order to get out and fight the charge, I had to pay $1,000 to a bail bondsman, a charge I can never recover. I couldn't afford the payment myself. I was lucky enough to have a friend who did. I know that my life would have been ruined if I'd had to plead guilty to something that I did not do. Micah Doktoroff, how often do people just plea bargain just to be able to get out?
I think it's unfortunately very common. People are desperate to get home to their families, get back to their jobs so that they don't lose their jobs, provide for their children, and people are concerned about the conditions that they are facing in jail. And so I think that that bail ends up being used in order to leverage plea bargains, and many, many people sort of out of this desperation to get out of jail end up pleading simply to move things forward. There are people who have not committed the crime for which they're accused, and still plead guilty simply to get home. We also see lots of people whose charges are ultimately dismissed. And I think as this writer highlighted, these people do not get their money back if they've paid a bail agency. People are typically paying roughly 10% of the full amount of bail set to the for-profit bail company, and that money is not refunded regardless of the outcome of the case. So if somebody did not commit the crime, if somebody's charges are dismissed, if somebody is acquitted, they still do not get that money back. And for many people, it does leave them potentially in debt for years and years, you know, well after the charges have been dismissed. A person or the person's family may still be in debt to the bail company for years to come.
Interesting you should say that, because the emailer goes on to say, as long as I was in jail, I had no way to defend myself. As it is, he had me arrested at work, so I lost my job. 5 years later, I am still struggling to get by. So we're going to, on the other side of the break, talk about some of the life impacts. What can happen if you find yourself under arrest and in detention without charge and facing a bail you can't pay? We hope you'll join us. Stay with us.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. The lines are filled up, but when one frees up, you're welcome to call us at 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at yourcallradio.
Welcome back. For those of you just joining us now, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're talking today with Joshua Norkin, staff attorney with Legal Aid of New York City's Special Litigation Unit, and Micah Doctoroff, a legislative attorney for the ACLU of California Center for Advocacy and Policy. And we are talking about bail, the system, and how to a great extent, those who can afford to get out of jail never have to spend a day, and those who can't afford it can often spend a great deal of time there to the detriment of their lives and families. We're podcasting the show. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. There you can listen to past shows and find out what's coming up next. We love it when you have show ideas, so please drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org or call us 866-798-8255. Coming up tomorrow, a conversation with former CIA analyst Mel Goodman about his new book, Whistleblower at the CIA, an insider's account of the politics of intelligence. Again, today we're talking about pretrial and bail bond systems. Of the approximately 700,000 people in jail on any given day in the U.S., more than 60% of them haven't even been sentenced. The majority of prisoners in local jails are serving time just because they can't afford to pay the pretrial bail bond. And since the 1980s, that sort of pretrial detention has far outpaced the number of people who are actually serving sentences based on having been adjudicated. So what has been your experience with the bail bond system? We hope you'll give us a call. Let's go to Joanne. Hi, Joanne. Thanks for being here.
Hi.
Hi.
First, I'd like to say that I think everybody should know how to bail themselves.
Can you turn your radio down, Joanne?
My radio's down.
Okay, thanks.
You should know how to get yourself out on a bond. You don't want to go to court. You want to get out before you go to court, because your bail could increase if you go to court, actually. They set a bond for you when you're first arrested, and it could be $2,000, but if the judge thinks that you need to be higher if you go to court, then it's going to be raised. So you need to know how to do it. And there's people in there you can ask, but they're not usually the kind of people you want to start talking to, really, you know. I found myself remanded from court, and I knew I would probably be released the next day when I went to court, but you just want to get out. You don't want to be in jail. It's not a place to be. And my cousin knew I was going to court, so she had already called the bondsman for me, so they knew who I was, and they took $60 from her, and I have a bill now that I still haven't paid for the rest of the bond. I don't even know how much the bond was, but they'll take anybody's money. They'll start asking, who do you know with money? Do you have a job? Who will give me any amount of money?
So, as usual, there is follow the money. Josh Norkin, staff attorney with Legal Aid in New York City, this has obviously become a for-profit money machine, right? Yes?
I think that's right. I think that there's been some recent reports sort of documenting this, including a big report that was done by the ACLU and a group called Color of Change that sort of documented the sort of dramatic growth and rise in the bail bond industry as something more than a mom-and-pop industry, but essentially as a major sort of corporate entity that is essentially siphoning money out of poor communities and lining the pockets of wealthier corporate shareholders. Bail bonds agencies are usually backed by large insurance companies. They're essentially an insurance company business. And locally here in New York, to sort of reinforce that point, we have just sort of seen a study released by the Brooklyn Community Bail Fund, which is a partner organization that we work with, that estimates that there are millions of dollars essentially being transferred from poor communities in different parts of New York City into the pocket of the for-profit bail bonds industry. And I think that's just the big picture. I think that on any sort of given day and on any sort of any specific interaction with bail bondsmen, there are people who are at their most vulnerable and they are being confronted with, legal language that they don't understand, contractual language that might not make sense to them. They may be told that they need to pay additional fees that may or may not be authorized by the statute. And the industry is largely operated in the shadows. So these types of abuses, I think, have gone largely unregulated and largely unseen. And I think some of the Color of Change report suggests that the reason for that is because of how powerful the lobbyists and corporate interests are backing the bail bond industry.
And there is a difference between corporate bail bond and that's posted directly with the court, yes?
So there is a difference. All bail bondsmen are insurance company agents, basically. There is a difference between cash bail that would be deposited directly with the court, in which you'd post the full cash amount. So if bail was $3,000, you'd leave $3,000 cash. And a difference between going to a bail bondsman where they would collect, maybe $300 as a premium on the $3,000 bond, and then would pay the rest of the bond for you. That $300 you would not get back. It's the fee that you pay to the bail bondsman, probably with some additional collateral, in order for them to pay the bond and to get you out of jail.
Micah Doctoroff, I'm sorry, go ahead. Did you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I was just going to say, I think Joshua brings up a really important point. The extraordinary wealth disparity that arises because of this system, or one of the incredible wealth disparities, is that we see that if somebody is able to pay the full amount of bail to the court, that money is then refunded to the person if they come to court. If somebody pays a premium to a for-profit bail company, that money is not refunded, even if the person comes to court. And so we see once again where people with means are able to, have an advantage over those without.
We talked a bit before the break about some of the life impacts, and our previous caller and emailer rather talked about how this event happened in her life years ago, and she still hasn't been able to regroup from it. So just can you talk a bit, Micah, about some of the impacts, the life impacts that people have when they are detained in this way?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that there's sort of two categories of negative impacts. One is for people who are detained pretrial, and one is for people who are able to scrape together some amount of money to pay a bail company. So I'll start with the former. People who are detained pretrial can easily and do easily lose their jobs, lose their transportation. People have their children taken away from them. People may lose their housing. And these are impacts that not only the person in jail is facing, but also that person's family and anybody who is dependent on that person. So individuals and whole communities are really suffering from individual detention. On the you know, outside of sort of life impacts, it also puts defendants at a significant disadvantage in terms of defending them against the charges that they are facing. I think somebody mentioned earlier that, you know, people who are detained don't have the same kind of access to their attorneys, don't have the same kind of access to witnesses or evidence, any of the means that they would be using to defend themselves. And so, once again, we see people who are unable to afford bail being put at a disadvantage. And as we discussed earlier, people end up being very desperate to get out of jail as quickly as possible, and end up potentially pleading to charges that they for crimes that they did not commit. We also see some national statistics that people who are in detention pre-trial are more likely to be convicted and are more likely to have longer sentences. So sort of at every step of the criminal process, people who are detained pretrial end up at a significant disadvantage. For people who are able to scrape together some amount of money to get out of jail to pay a bail company, oftentimes people cannot afford even the 10% we discussed earlier. You know, that people have a difficult time even making a payment of $400. So say your 10% of your full amount of bail is $5,000, that's still significantly out of reach. And so what we see from a lot of for-profit bail companies is that they will put people on payment plans with high interest rates, and then people end up indebted for potentially years and years. We've heard of cases where, you know, charges have been dismissed, or where the case is resolved and the person pays their debt to society and serves out their sentence, but they're still making payments to the bail company. And so it's really sort of akin to other types of predatory lending that we see where people, long after their case is resolved, continue to suffer.
Predatory and coercive. There's apparently just a whole lot of reasons that you do whatever you have to get out. And if you can't, then you're a victim of the system. An email from James says, when I was in southern Florida, county jailers would often beat and terrorize arrestees, threatening to hold them for 179 days unless one pled out. It was a machine processing quote-unquote felony cases at the rate of one plea every 6 minutes in dozens of courtrooms. He goes on to write, my former attorney, I just found out, was on drugs during the 80s, so now I'm filing to reverse my entire case. It happened back in the 80s, and sometime during that time, the federal court stepped in and told the courts 180 days is not a speedy trial, and these counties felonize innocent people every day. Joshua Norkin, is that true? Counties felonizing innocent people, literally felonizing them?
I, I've not heard that particular term before, but I think that the sentiments that are being expressed in that email are entirely valid. It's certainly something that I have often heard from my clients and from the people that we represent here in New York City. I think that this general idea that the emailer is sort of putting forth in suggesting that jail is a very brutal place where disadvantaged people are routinely taken advantage of by the people in power, whether that's guards, judges, even sometimes their own defense attorney in the worst case situations. I mean, these are all byproducts of a criminal justice system that is essentially rotten to its very core. And it starts before bail. It starts with discriminatory policing tactics, and it carries itself all the way through to the very end when somebody perhaps is pleading guilty of something that they didn't do. And, we've sort of talked about this, I think, a lot now at this point, but it certainly is pretty clear that pretrial detention, essentially being jailed before you have been convicted of anything, whether that is being jailed on money bail, whether it's being jailed because you've been remanded on a more serious charge, or because a risk assessment said that you should be jailed, that is something that causes people to plead guilty. It disproportionately harms poor people, particularly people of color, and it's something that is, when we talk about closing down a place like Rikers Island, that caller sentiments are why we are trying to do that, because jails are brutal places where people are mistreated. And, part of this entire movement is trying to figure out a way to close those places and to restore some dignity and some due process to people who have otherwise been taken advantage of.
Lots of people are wanting to weigh in on this. What questions might you have about our pretrial and bail bond system? Let's go to Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann.
Good morning. My question is based on a piece I just read in the New York Review of Books by David Cole, who mentioned that, not to dispute the article in the book, The New Jim Crow, or other books about disproportionately jailing African Americans, the two books mentioned, or David Cole in the article mentioned, the role of prosecutorial discretion in all of this. And I was wondering, in the bail bond system, do prosecutors play any role?
Micah, can you address that?
Yes. I mean, I think that in a variety of ways, prosecutors are determining the charges against a person. And so when bail is set according to simply the person's charges, prosecutors end up playing a really significant role. Additionally, because, as we discussed earlier, we see people who end up pleading guilty to crimes simply as a way to either get out of jail because they're unable to afford the amount of bail set, that is a tool that prosecutors can wield. We see that most cases end up being resolved through plea, and a lot of that is because people are in jail pretrial and aren't able to participate in their defense in the way that somebody who is released pretrial might. I think that it's really important to note that the charging decisions, prosecutors' charging decisions, both in terms of how much the bail will be, and also how likely it will be for somebody to end up pleading based on the charging decision.
You know, it's also interesting that the Human Rights Watch report talked about risk assessments. In other words, when a judge is trying to identify how much bail to set, there was a database approach. But apparently data was also skewed so that even with the risk assessments, people of color were disproportionately being meted out higher bails. Is that your take on the Human Rights Watch report, Josh?
Yes, I think that's in essence what one of the points that the Human Rights Watch report raised in their concerns about using risk assessments as a replacement or as part of making a bail determination. And I think essentially the argument is that because we have risk assessments are essentially computer algorithms that are relying on past data to then essentially group an individual into a category of risk based on what other people had done in the past. And that data that's used to sort of calculate the risk assessment comes from the criminal justice system. It depends on how the risk assessment is made and adapted, but a lot of them rely on arrests or convictions as part of their data points in determining what risk category somebody's going to fall into. And the argument is essentially that because it relies on essentially a broken and racist criminal justice system to begin with, the input metrics are going to taint the output metrics, meaning that because we overpolice communities of color and because they've been disproportionately arrested and disproportionately convicted, that the risk assessment is then going to give us results that categorize people of color as higher risk than their white counterparts. And that's probably also true if you look at it from the wealth angle as well. And I think that's just one of the many points that Human Rights Watch raised as a concern about adopting risk assessments in reforming a bail statute.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Micah.
Yeah, and the ACLU certainly shares many of those concerns, risk assessment tools being used inappropriately in a way that increases racial disparities in the criminal justice system. We are very pleased by the fact that here in California, recent legislation, the California Money Bail Reform Act of 2017, authored by Senator Bob Hertzberg and Assemblymember Rob Bonta, and co-sponsored by the ACLU along with eight other organizations, addresses those concerns and includes the types of safeguards that have been identified by researchers across the country, public defenders, other criminal defense attorneys, and subject matter experts. It includes the safeguards that have been identified to ward against those potential consequences of sort of inappropriate use of risk assessment tools, and instead, sort of regulates their use and promotes their use in such a way that can ultimately and ideally result in there being less bias in the pretrial decision-making process.
And that California Money Bail Reform Act of 2017 also says that each county could establish its own pretrial services agency, right, to track the inmates who have been released, remind them of court dates, basically develop a support system. Yes?
Yes, exactly. So, the pretrial system proposed by the legislation, is really focusing on a system that would be more equitable, would treat people with dignity and respect, and would more effectively serve the intended purpose of pretrial systems, which is to return people to court and promote public safety. And so one piece of it is shifting away from a wealth-based system to a system that evaluates
risk, people's likelihood to come back to court, and you know, whether the person would compromise community safety. And then the other piece is using pretrial services, using evidence-based practices to help mitigate any potential risk that is identified. And those types of services, you know, will vary from person to person based on the individual circumstances of that person and the individual case. So, you know, it ends up replacing a system, again, that is primarily wealth-based and is not typically doing an individualized assessment and shifting to a system that, you know, we've seen work in other parts of the country with great success, where people are no longer being detained simply for being unable to afford bail, and potentially increasing the likelihood that people will come to court and that people will remain arrest-free during the pretrial stage because they have resources.
Let's get Joshua Norkin. Your final thoughts, Joshua, from your perspective, what would effective reform look like?
I think effective reform varies probably from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. You know, I think that what might be happening in California, for example, might not be good for what's going on here in New York City. So I think that, you know, essentially the national conversation seems to be that everybody is on board with this idea that we need to end money bail and need to end the jailing of people because they're too poor to get out. I think that, you know, from my perspective, I think that's right. But I also, to me, I want to find ways that we're going to not just close jails, but also release people with as few restrictions on their liberty as we possibly can. And I think that there are, you know, for here in New York, we have sort of specifically, as defenders, rejected this idea that a risk assessment is an appropriate or even a necessary way to do something like that. So I think, you know, it's going to be a jurisdiction by jurisdiction approach. And I think, you know, here in New York, we're sort of waiting to see what some of these, you know, recent reforms in other states are going to produce. But I think everybody is on board with the, you know, the very basic idea that you cannot keep somebody in jail because they're poor. You cannot disproportionately harm either poor people or people of color. And that's got to stop, and it's got to stop. And the best way to achieving that is a comprehensive approach that involves changing things like the speedy trial statute, due process laws to ensure that people have an equitable and full transparent hearing about whether or not they should be detained pretrial. It includes eliminating the use of money bail on misdemeanors, nonviolent felonies, and it includes sort of diverting a lot of cases from the criminal justice system to begin with.
Okay, Josh, we're going to jump in because I want to make sure that people know who we were talking to today on this. Joshua Norkin, staff attorney with Legal Aid Society of New York City Special Litigation Unit, and Micah Doctoroff, legislative attorney for the ACLU of California. Fascinating subject. So glad you all weighed in. Your call produced at KALW. You can listen to past shows at yourcallradio.org. This has been Your Call. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Join us next when we'll talk about the CIA. That's tomorrow.